This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 12, 2000. I'm Max Pringle. Coming up, 4 million South African workers walk off the job to protest their government cozying up to international capital. Lawyers for jailed IMF World Bank protesters prepare to file a class action lawsuit against the D.C. police and U.S. Marshals. And a look at the leading challenger to Mexico's long-ruling PRI party. All this and more this week on Free Speech Radio News. South Africa's powerful Congress of South African Trade Unions, which helped topple apartheid, are now turning their attention to global trade. About half of the country's workers walked off the job this week to protest U.S. Congress's passage of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, along with South African government policies. Patrick Bond reports from Johannesburg.
About half of South Africa's 8 million workers walked off the job as part of the first major national strike in 4 years. Around 200,000 turned out for marches in the main cities. This was a far greater show of force than predicted by ruling African National Congress officials, who strongly opposed their normal allies, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the strike has shaken big business. The workers' demands were first for big businesses to end the waves of layoffs, which have cost 1 million jobs since the ANC came to power in 1994, and second for the government to reverse its job-killing economic policies, which were designed in part by the World Bank in 1996. Neither demand will be met in the short term, but the mass strike has raised confidence and preparedness for further action. Likewise, South African trade union leaders bemoan the recent passage in the U.S. Congress of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which, along with a similar European free trade deal, is expected to cost many more local jobs. With social and labor movements in countries as diverse as Bolivia and Thailand protesting against neoliberal policies like this in recent weeks, it was only a matter of time before Africa's most organized and militant working class awoke to resume its struggle for liberation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Patrick Bond in Johannesburg.
Renewed fighting in Sierra Leone this week as 9 UN peacekeepers were wounded, 3 critically, after a friendly fire incident in which government troops mistook them for rebels and captured UN uniforms. The incident coincided with reports from civilians that rebels, holding 500 hostages, were advancing on the capital, Freetown. Military officials say that government and UN troops have held the rebels back with the help of British paratroopers. The Rebel Revolutionary United Front, notorious for forcing children to fight and hacking off the limbs of civilians, hold the country's valuable diamond fields. I spoke with Ian Smiley, an analyst with the Canadian group Partnership for Africa. He says the diamond trade has played a major role in the 9-year civil war.
Well, the diamond trade has been central. It's been central to the war. The war began in 1991, and at the beginning, the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, said that what they were interested in was democracy. But in fact, there's been a democratically elected government in Sierra Leone since 1996, and they've really stepped up their brutality since then. Really, it's not about tribalism. There's never been any tribalism involved in this. It's not about justice or democracy or freedom or anything like that. It's really only about one thing, the diamonds and the power that would go with them.
Tell me more about Fode Sanko, the rebel leader.
What I know about him is what I've either read or heard from people who've met with him. The Canadian foreign minister met with him about 10 days ago and came away with a very, very negative impression that he simply was not interested in peace. Some people call him a sociopath. He denies the atrocities. At one point he said there were only five amputees, which is, you know, why anybody would even report that, I don't know, except to demonstrate that he's a liar or nuts. He's never apologized or exhibited any remorse at all for what's happened, and usually denies, in fact, that the RUF has had anything to do with it.
It appears that Fode Sanko and his group are rather sadistic people. There are reports that his followers are amputating the limbs of children as young as 9 months old.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are camps in Freetown and other parts of Sierra Leone that are filled with people, all of them civilians, men, women, and very often children, including little girls and boys, babies even, that have had this kind of amputation. I mean, the low number is 2,000. I've heard 4, but, you know, probably only 1 in 10 who has that kind of an amputation would survive. I mean, these are just done with axes in the woods. I mean, it's horrible. It's unbelievable.
What are the possibilities for positive change and an end to the brutality?
the only possibility of change is if law and order prevails in the country, and that hasn't been the case now for many years. The peace agreement that was signed last summer, the Lomé agreement, with signed between the government and the RUF, the government signed it reluctantly. They had their back to the wall militarily, and they knew that they would lose if they didn't sign some kind of a peace agreement. The deal was that the UN would send in a peacekeeping force, and that gave the government a bit of a breather. But I don't think anybody was under any illusion that the RUF would keep the peace. They've done this in the past, and really they were just waiting for their chance. Until there is a force there that is properly equipped and properly trained with the right marching orders, in other words, until there's a force there that is willing and able to shoot back and put down some of these atrocities, the thing will never end.
Usually in these third world conflicts, we see that behind the scenes, the role of major powers. Is that the case in Sierra Leone?
Well, that's an interesting question. No, there aren't any major powers behind this, except, you might say, the diamond industry. But there certainly is a power behind it, and that is the president of Liberia, Charles Taylor. He has provided the base for the rebels. He provided the training. He's provided the weapons. He's often provided Liberian guerrillas or mercenaries to go in and work with the RUF. And he's provided the base, the transit camp for the diamonds that come out of Sierra Leone on their way to Belgium in exchange for guns.
Ian Smiley is an analyst with the Partnership for Africa based in Ottawa. Mexico's Institutional Revolutionary Party has maintained a 7-decades-long grip on power, largely through electoral fraud and corruption. Enter Vicente Fox, an upstart candidate and former provincial governor. Stumping for votes around Mexico, Fox has managed to make a big dent in the PRI's lead. Free Speech Radio's Kent Patterson has more on this unlikely political spoiler.
In an Acapulco hall, supporters of Mexican presidential candidate Vicente Fox whip up a frenzy. Fox is the candidate of the Alliance for Change, a two-party coalition that unites the Conservative National Action Party, PAN, with the Mexican Green Party. A rancher and former PAN governor of the state of Guanajuato, Fox is brash, outspoken, and a master of tailoring his message to suit the audience.
Hemos propuesto alcanzar esa meta porque es el mínimo indispensable.
At this meeting, Fox is accompanied by a famous Mexican actress, Luz María Aguilar. Fox's words are sharp but toned down for this urban middle-class crowd. On other occasions, when he speaks to rural audiences, the tall Fox dons cowboy boots and hat and makes vulgar references to Francisco Labastida, his opponent from the long-ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, PRI. Recent polls indicate Fox and Labastida are running neck to neck, but tonight Fox is diplomatic.
De consumir nuestros recursos naturales, de contaminar el medio ambiente para lograr.
Fox's main proposal is to create jobs and reduce the unequal distribution of wealth in Mexico. Another Fox priority is reforming the country's troubled educational system. Although his proposals are vague, Fox sometimes comes across as a populist. Two prominent left intellectuals, Jorge Castañeda and Adolfo Zinser, serve as key advisors. Yet in recent months, he has moved toward the political center. Fox promises to withdraw the Mexican army from Chiapas, but at the same time, vows to crack down on armed rebel groups in the state of Guerrero. Campaign workers like Isidro Radia say they will take his message to the masses.
We're going to begin with a new campaign called We Matter with Fox. This campaign proposes to adopt indigenous communities in Guerrero. The objective is to help them and teach them new technology. For instance, if they need a school, make a school. If they need water, bring them water. Drill them a well. In this way, we're helping the Mexican people as well as the Fox campaign.
Estamos a todo mundo a que participe, a que abran los ojos
We invite everyone to open their eyes. It's been proven that the best states in the Mexican Republic are the ones which are governed by the PAN. We invite the people of Guerrero and Mexico to open their eyes and see the difference that exists between the states governed by the PAN and the rest of the Mexican Republic.
A one-time manager for Coca-Cola before becoming the PAN governor of Guanajuato, Vicente Fox points to the growth of employment in his home state as proof that he can bring changes. Another state governed by the PAN is here in Aguascalientes, which has been turned into a center of foreign-owned assembly plants known as maquiladoras. While many people work in the maquiladoras, wages are low, a few dollars a day, in a country where the cost of living now rivals that of the United States.
No estamos recurriendo a la mercadotecnia en la televisión, ¿sí?
But not everyone in Aguascalientes is happy with the PAN or Vicente Fox. Marco Vinicio Saldana is a campaign coordinator for Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, the presidential candidate of the center-left coalition called the Alliance for Mexico. Vinicio Saldana says the real issue in this year's presidential election is whether Mexico will remain a sovereign nation. While Fox and the PAN are generally supportive of economic privatizations and free trade agreements, Vinicio Saldana says that Cárdenas and the Alliance for Mexico want to redefine Mexico's position in the international economy and revise sections of the North American Free Trade Agreement that hurt Mexican agriculture and migrant workers. Meanwhile, the Mexican media is increasingly narrowing the race down to two choices, Vicente Fox or the ruling party's Francisco Labastida. In the process, they are marginalizing Cárdenas, who is considered in third place behind Labastida and Fox, as well as three other minor party candidates. But many Mexicans, fed up with 7 decades of pre-rule, say they will cast their ballot for Vicente Fox as the best hope of political change. For Free Speech News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
In March, California voters overwhelmingly passed Proposition 21, the Get Tough juvenile justice measure, which allows children as young as 14 to be tried as adults. In the coming years, the measure will likely put thousands of kids behind bars. Most of those young felons will go to California Youth Authority prisons, where instances of brutality are common. Aaron Glantz reports from Sacramento.
Allegations of brutality in the California Youth Authority are many and severe. State Senator Richard Polanco is a frequent critic of the CYA. He describes the charges.
The abuse of words as being used as experiments, the sexual misconduct of staff with words.
One civil rights lawsuit filed in March charged a female inmate was forced to be the personal concubine of a prison guard. In response to the allegations, the head of the youth authority and the superintendents of 2 CYA facilities were forced to resign. But critics of the CYA say little has changed since the firings. They say the abuses are systematic rather than a series of isolated incidents. For example, the state's prison teachers say very little education takes place in California's prisons. In part because they are often forced to do other jobs like cooking and mopping. Andy Shaw Corn is a teacher at Soledad State Prison. He spoke at a rally in front of the State Department of Corrections.
So in the Department of Corrections, they've used teachers as kind of interchangeable labor so that when there's lockdowns and the inmates are not available, they put teachers to work making sandwiches, searching cells, doing help with custody concerns, basically using them any way possible, just as extra labor.
Richard Rios teaches at the Youth Receiving Center in Sacramento. He says those who complain about the conditions are punished.
All of a sudden, somebody comes in, CCPOA, a guard, that classification, a custody-type person, and they'll do a close-down where they close the classroom down, and they'll search that classroom. Now, in some instances in the past, we've had searches go where they take materials off the walls, like the boards, like the, you know, actually strip the walls completely bare to see if there's any contraband, and all in the name of safety, not only for the teacher, but for the inmate or the ward. So what happens is the teacher's room has been totally disrupted. Whether or not there was anything found is immaterial.
State prison officials don't dispute the fact that teachers are often required to do jobs unrelated to education. They say the practice is justified, and they say such a statement needs to be put in perspective. Steve Green is the Assistant Secretary of Youth and Adult Corrections in California.
The population in the CYA has changed a lot. We used to have vocational schools. Then a few years ago, there were changes in the budget that encouraged most counties to keep their best wards, the people who don't have behavior problems, the people who want to learn, want to straighten their lives out. And those going to the CYA today are very different than 5 years ago when everybody was going. Now we're getting people who are serious criminals, who have mental health problems, who have violent behaviors that we have to deal with. That kind of person used to make up maybe anywhere from 5 to 15% of the CYA. Now it's most of the CYA.
All of these problems are likely to get worse in the coming months. Now that Tough on Crime Proposition 21 has been sustained by the state Supreme Court, the 7,000 inmate youth authority can expect to be deluged with new wards. And the state's prison teachers say while young felons serve time in the youth authority, little effort will be made to ensure they will leave the state's prison system productive members of society. They say both the state and federal government are abandoning the prospect of rehabilitating young criminals. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Sacramento.
While the police department seemed more restrained on the streets of Washington than in Seattle, behind the scenes, officials came down hard on IMF World Bank activists. Demonstrators jailed during last month's protests say they were physically and psychologically abused by law enforcement. They also say they were intimidated and deceived by judges and court-appointed attorneys. Lawyers for the defendants are gearing up for a class action suit. Allison Hawks reports.
Arrested activists are reporting serious violations of their constitutional and human rights in the hands of law enforcement officials and during their judicial proceedings in the Washington, D.C. jails. The reports range from physical abuse and psychological intimidation to denial of food, water, bathrooms, and medical care for long periods of time. Women activists report being strip-searched in public hallways and patted down by male officers. A group of women were asked to pull down their pants, squat, and cough while male officers watched. Activists were repeatedly denied access to their attorneys. Gay rights activist Chris Hermes came to Washington from Philadelphia. He said that activists who refused to give their names were subject to manipulation and scare tactics by the authorities. Hermes said that after being arrested, he and others were held in the basement of a District of Columbia courthouse and in the custody of U.S. Marshals for 24 hours before arraignment in court.
What the marshals were doing was just basically threatening us, telling us that we didn't want to go into jail. There were murderers and rapists there, and this was no ballpark. At the same time, they were abusing us physically. They were also verbally abusing us.
That's a story repeated many times by jailed activists. Marshals reportedly told activists there were no cameras around. Marshals said they could do whatever they want. Activists asked for food, water, and blankets in jail, but they say those calls went unanswered. Jennifer Hyland is a UC Berkeley student. Hyland said one activist suffered from hypothermia but did not get medical treatment.
She basically, you could tell she was suffering from the initial hypothermia shock, and she needed medical attention, and so we demanded, we're like, she needs to go see a medic, you know. After an hour, someone came to take her away, and 10 hours later, they bring her back to our cell where we learned that she had basically been in a cell by herself for 10 hours and received no medical attention.
The U.S. Marshals denied these allegations and said that their department did not have extended contact with the activists. Marshall Dillard is a U.S. Marshal for the Superior Court of D.C.
The only thing we do is take them from the cell block in the courthouse to the courtroom to be heard and back to the cell block. And from there, they go back to the Department of Corrections.
But activists were held for over a day in the courthouse basement before being handed over to the Department of Corrections at the jail. Activists said their guards were identifiably U.S. Marshals because they had U.S. Marshal badges on their uniforms. Dillard said U.S. Marshals are not allowed to give food or medication to detainees. That's the job of the arresting agency. And Sergeant Joe Gentile, spokesperson for the Metropolitan Police Department, said the department provided arrested activists with as much as they could under the circumstances.
As far as I know, they were given facilities when possible. Again, you're dealing with a large number of people. and the facilities may not be that many compared to the size of the group you're dealing with.
Hundreds of activists remained in solidarity with each other in the jails, refusing to give their names so that the city prosecutors had to deal with them collectively. Activists gained leverage in setting forth their demands for equal treatment, same charges for everyone dropped to a traffic infraction, and anonymity to protect foreign nationals and those with previous criminal records. But according to witnesses, judges, like the law enforcement officials, tried to manipulate activists into giving their names because there was not enough room in the jails to hold them all. Katya Kamasurik, an attorney for the activists, said she watched as one judge repeatedly lied to groups of activists.
She would bring activists into the courtroom, 3 to 5 at a time, and she made the identical speech to them, which was, hundreds of people have already come through my courtroom. They're all giving their names. Nobody is doing the solidarity thing. Only a handful of people have refused to cooperate. You've made your point. It's time to give your name and go home.
A number of activists were brought to the courthouse and fired their court-appointed attorneys in front of the judge. Kamasurik, who led the negotiations with the city prosecutors on behalf of the activists for their release, said only after this point were their demands taken seriously. At the end of 5 days, the negotiations ended and charges were dropped on nearly every activist. Kamasurik said the abuse the activists suffered in Washington, D.C. is part of a larger national effort to silence the movement.
It seems like it's a pattern here, that there's a policy being enacted to try to frighten people, to deter them from protesting in the first place. And that's what's really scary, because once you lose the right to talk about your rights, then how will you ever implement them?
Kamasurik said law enforcement officials may use similar tactics in Los Angeles and Philadelphia for the upcoming protests against the Democratic and Republican national conventions. Already, these cities have purchased over $2 million in new riot gear. The demonstrators' legal team is gearing up for a class action suit against the law enforcement agencies, and individuals are filing separate suits. A number of legal firms have come together to investigate constitutional violations during the IMF World Bank demonstrations and to plan for prosecution. Kamasurik said they hope to proceed quickly in order to deter such future heavy-handed responses by authorities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Allison Hawks.
They're both from Kosovo. She's a Serb. He's an Albanian. She risked her life during last year's bombing to help her Albanian boyfriend and family. He'll never forget that she's estranged from her family for choosing to be with him. They've stuck it out all these years, but the lingering resentment in Kosovo is costing them dearly. Sputnik Columbia reports from Pristina on a Balkan love story.
I was really, really scared because of everything, because of bombing. I was afraid of airplanes, and I was afraid on the ground, and I was afraid to lose him. But I just can't realize what we survive.
Maria Vukic and Yeton Berisha sip orange juice on the terrace of the bar and appear like any of the countless young couples in Kosovo, half of whose population is under 25. Another glorious spring day in Pristina. The sun is high, the sky blue. The relaxed atmosphere makes it easy to forget that the hotel was once the HQ of the Yugoslav army, that yesterday, like today, love stories across the ethnic divide were a complicated business.
I know that Serbs from my town, from our town, they hated me, really. And my opinion about this is that I knew that sometimes this has to be solved, this problem, because everyone knows that Albanian here is majority. And
yet you both speak Serbian together.
Yeah, yes, of course. Till she teaches the Albanian, I think.
Till she learns Albanian.
Yeah, learns Albanian, yeah. But I'm used to speak with her in Serbian, so it's not a problem.
The sunshine is deceptive. The terrace where Yeton and Maria enjoy an early spring is within the barbed wire UN complex, one of the few protected spots in Pristina where minorities are not at risk. Yeton and Maria can speak Serbian freely here. In the streets, Maria lets her Albanian friend do the talking.
Of course, I'm afraid of her future. If somebody do something better, you know, if they don't like Serbians, they can, you know, I know that she is a good human being.
What are the things you feel you cannot do because you're not from the same ethnic community?
If I go alone, I can go out, but together with freely, I cannot go out and walk on streets. And this is the first, or in some Albanian bars and sitting with the Serbian girl.
We can't go out, and sometimes when I go to shop with him, my mouth are shut, and only he speaks. And usually we never go out, usually never. We are only staying at my place because I'm what I am.
It's tough going for everybody in Kosovo today, the huge international presence, including the thousands in uniform, notwithstanding. Yeton and Maria have come out of the war, scarred like everybody else. They too are trying to pick up the pieces and carry on. But the reality is grim, despite all the talk of building a multi-ethnic Kosovo.
I'm innocent, of course. She's innocent of all those things what's happened here. I know also what before was happened here, so I can understand also those people who cannot understand me why I'm together with her. But I think that everyone has to leave, everyone have right to leave and try to forget the past and take steps for future.
Can you understand that it will take time for people here to forget and forgive what has happened?
I don't agree that all national community is guilty for something. I don't agree about that. Because I don't know, people who stayed here, probably they stayed here because they didn't do anything and they don't have a reason to be afraid. But there are extremists on both sides.
Both sides think that they have right, maybe, I don't know for what, but the things they have right that to be extremists, to put, and in first place, extremism and after normal. Our representatives, I think they represent a part of Albanian people. There is the other voice who international community have to find out here. Yeah, other people who can represent Kosovo. People here are good, but we don't have those representatives we deserve. When a man loves a woman. I would like to live here forever, and also for her, and because Maria, she is a Serbian, but she is a citizen of Kosovo, and she also have a right to live here. Nobody is not have right to push her to leave Kosovo, and we will try to do our best and keep our patience.
I don't know. I will see if I have patience. Like, I'm here because of him. I will believe in good future. But when I get back into realistic life, when I wake up in the morning and when I walk scared in the street, I don't know. Should I think in positive way, or should I just accept realism? But I want to see what will be in the future. Well,
this man loves you, mama. This is Sputnik Kilambi in Pristina.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 Pacifica reporters from across Europe, Asia, and the Americas have been on strike for over a month to protest censorship of legitimate news stories at Pacifica Network News. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. To find out more about the strike, go to www.savepacifica.net/strike. That's www.savepacifica.net/strike. Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz and Andrea Sears. Matt Martin is distribution coordinator. Technical assistance from Bob Mason and Josh Thayer. Thanks to the National Radio Project for leasing a space. I'm Max Pringle. Thanks for listening.